Hola, and welcome to NPR's movie podcast, a roundup of movie coverage from National Public Radio. This week, an interview with actress Kristin Scott Thomas. NPR's Elizabeth Blair has the backstory of a new murder film. Actor Philip Seymour Hoffman explains how to pronounce the title of his new film. And commentator John Ridley wonders if Hollywood is recession-proof. But first, NPR film critic Bob Mondello revisits the ABCs of the movies.
Last week, Bob Mondello reviewed W. That's Oliver Stone's film about the relationship between George Bush Sr. and George W. Bush. In his review, Bob suggested that if someone had made a movie about John Adams and his presidential son, John Quincy Adams, it could have been called Q. And then a listener weighed in. Here's Bob.
I got an email after my review last week suggesting that W might make a good triple feature with the 60s political thriller Z and with Spike Lee's African-American biopic X. It wouldn't actually be a good triple feature. W's not in the same league as the other two films, and anyway, Spike Lee's picture is called Malcolm X. But the concept is a grabber. W, X, and Z. All we need is a Y. Back when I worked at a chain of movie theaters, the manager of our repertory house would have killed for a triple feature that would fit that easily on his marquee. One-letter titles were hard to come by. There was M, Fritz Lang's German crime thriller from the 1930s, and the 50s American remake. That would give you M&M as a double feature. Or Q, a horror flick about a flying lizard that you could pair with a snake movie called where the title was just a bunch of S's. If only there'd been texting back then, you might have been able to get away with T and Sympathy, or Pee-wee's Big Adventure, or the Spanish film I, Carmela, where I is really spelled A-Y. Some letters lend themselves to this kind of treatment, others not so much. X's are everywhere, possibly playing off the old racy movie rating, X. That was the idea with Roger Corman's X, where the ads noted that Ray Milland's X-ray eyes let him see through clothes. There's also the Vin Diesel action flick XXX, not to mention X-Men and X-Files, and this past summer, an Argentine film used the chromosome symbols XX for female and XY for male to come up with the title XXY for a story about a hermaphrodite. But L? Lots harder. For the longest time, the only L title I could come up with was L. Cid, and that's clearly cheating. You'd think there'd be a French film called L, spelled E-L-L-E, but I've never seen one. There's the L word on TV, of course. For K, there's K2, about the second highest mountain in the world, and for D, there's D2, the sequel to The Mighty Ducks, also D-Day. But for J, I've got nothing, nor for N, unless you'll give me N-Forcer. And oddly, the three letters that say alphabet best of all, A, B, C, turn out to be among the least used in this way in titles. For B, there's Jerry Seinfeld's B-movie, but for C, you have to go back 38 years to Joe Namath's biker gang flick, CC and Company. And for A, apart from animated shorts and obscure documentaries, I was coming up totally blank until a friend who's more literary than I suggested an elegant finesse, Daniel Day-Lewis and Demi Moore in that bright red A for adultery movie, The Scarlet Letter. I say give that guy an A for alphabetical effort and acknowledge his superior movie, IQ. I'm Bob Mondello.
Gigi. Am I a fool without a mind, or have I merely been too blind to realize?
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel in New York. I've been here all week reporting on the financial crisis. But I also had the opportunity to talk with actress Kristin Scott Thomas. She was Hugh Grant's ever single friend in Four Weddings and a Funeral back in 1994. And she played the romantic lead in The English Patient. Here she is with Ralph Fiennes.
Why did you follow me yesterday?
I'm sorry, what?
After the market, you followed me to the hotel.
I was concerned for a woman in that part of Cairo, a European woman, and I felt obliged to.
You felt obliged to?
As the wife of one of our party.
So why follow me? Escort me, by all means, but following me is predatory, isn't it?
For that role, Kristin Scott Thomas was nominated for an Oscar. She's currently on Broadway in Chekhov's The Seagull, and here she is in her latest film. It's called I've Loved You So Long. And in this scene, she is sharing a secret with the actress who plays her sister.
J'ai couché avec un homme la semaine dernière.
Quoi?
J'ai couché avec un homme la semaine dernière.
Où?
Un type. Dans un café. On est allé à l'hôtel.
If you're confused, it's because I've Loved You So Long is the English title of the subtitled version of Il y a longtemps que je t'aime, a French movie, and Kristin Scott Thomas, when she's not being an English actress, is equally a French actress.
Yes.
How did this happen?
Well, it happened very naturally. At 19, I moved to Paris, sort of slamming the door of my drama school because they said I wasn't good enough to be an actress. And so I decided to leave and try and forget about wanting to be an actress and ended up in France. There I got into drama school and just started working very small parts in very small films and then slightly larger parts in slightly larger films. And then I got discovered by Prince, the singer, making a film in the south of France. I was hired as a sort of local actress who could speak English. And then 7 years ago, I did my first play, which was Bérénice, which is in Avignon, in the theatre festival there.
So Racine, French drama we're talking about.
Baptism of Fire, let me tell you. And so I've been working in France for 25 years.
Yeah, it's very puzzling. I saw the French thriller Tell No One, and came away thinking there's a French actress who just reminds me incredibly of Kristin Scott Thomas, and was informed at that moment that indeed it was you. How different is it to act in French and to act in English?
It's the same thing. It's just the structure of the film set. It's slightly different in that there isn't so much hierarchy and it's more décontracté. You know, it's more, you get more of the feeling of something being homemade. The budgets are smaller, so there's less tension. It's more relaxed. It's fun. But it's the same process for me, you know. I'm pretending to be someone else.
The movie that's now opening in the United States, I've Loved You So Long, just in New York and Los Angeles at first. In it, you play a character who is withdrawn for good reason, as it turns out. But the challenge is one of being rather absent from the movie.
Yeah, she's really switched off. This woman has closed down and does not want communication, does not want to feel anything, does not want to express anything. She is a woman carrying a secret deep inside her and doesn't want anyone else to be in on that secret. And it was a challenge playing that part, but that's what we all crave, all us actresses. We all crave challenge. And that's one of the problems with working, certainly in the film industry, is that you're not often given that challenge.
I mean, I would have thought you could have your pick of whatever you wanted to do.
No, it's a problem in that people will constantly want you to be able to reproduce the latest hit, to reproduce the success of your last film, if your last film was a success.
Right.
So I've had quite a lot of aristocratic English adulteresses under my belt, which of course is, you know, it's just one thing that I'm able to do. Yeah.
You've had enough of that?
Yeah, but I always see, I have had enough of it, but you know, that's the work that's there, and I'm a working actress, and sometimes you just have to do what's there.
You're appearing in New York in The Seagull for how much longer?
And only until December, just before Christmas. We all have to get back to our families.
And Arkadina, the woman you play in that, an over-the-top actress.
Just be careful about what you say about her, because I'm very, very fond of her. And I do identify very strongly with this woman, being a mother, being an actress, having all the anxieties that I think, I can't believe an actress who says she doesn't have these anxieties of not working again, of getting older and seeing other actresses come up, of being concerned about your child's welfare, whether he's going to do well. All the sort of love that she has for her family, and this guilt that she's never there, she's always going away, she's always got suitcases, she's always coming, or she's just arrived, or she's just about to leave, or and this feeling of responsibility towards this family because she's become famous, and the play deals with this fascination with fame. It's just such a marvelous play. I love this part so much, and I know she's sort of riddled with faults, but I can't help but love her. And I get rather upset when people say
if we're too critical
and twisted
about
and aging, and reality hurts.
We're cutting close to the bone. You feel, Wendy?
I do.
But the connection with fame is very interesting. When you
yes,
say that, isn't
yes,
it? You've experienced it in your life.
I have experienced it in my life. The one thing that Nina says, she thought that famous people would live with, you know, in a sort of rarefied atmosphere, but here they are crying and going fishing, and so there is, you know, even at that time. Well, of course, at that time there was this fascination with celebrity. The truth that comes out in the end, that it's not all about fame. It's about being able to endure, and I think that is absolutely the vital thing. And in my career, anyway, I mean, that's what I want to be able to do. I want to be able to keep on going for a long, long time because I love what I do so much.
Well, Kristin Scott Thomas, thank you very much for talking with us.
It's been a pleasure.
Kristin Scott Thomas's new movie is called I've Loved You So Long, and she's also performing in New York on stage in Chekhov's The Seagull.
A serial killer, a corrupt police department, and a missing child. Clint Eastwood's new movie opening today is a true crime story based on one of the most bizarre and tragic crime stories of the 1920s. NPR's Elizabeth Blair takes a look at the real events that inspired Changeling.
It's a story with so many strange turns and outlandish characters, screenwriter Joe Straczynski didn't believe it at first. A former journalist in Los Angeles, Straczynski first heard about Christine Collins from one of his old sources at City Hall, who told him where to find more about her in the archives.
When I read over the transcript and I saw what had happened, I thought, this can't be real, this has to be a mistake.
Christine Collins, played by Angelina Jolie, was a single mom whose 9-year-old son, Walter, went missing in March of 1928. About 5 months later, a runaway from Illinois showed up, pretending to be Walter.
I live at 210 Avenue 23, Los Angeles, California. And that's my mommy.
When Christine Collins insisted the boy was not her son, Los Angeles Police Captain J.J. Jones dismissed her.
Why aren't you listening to me?
I am listening, damn it. I am listening. And I understand your feelings. He's changed, no mistake. And that's, you've both been through a terrible experience, and that's why he needs your love and support to bounce back.
He's not my son.
But Christine Collins took the boy home anyway. 3 weeks later, she returned to the LAPD to say she was absolutely certain he was not her son. The police captain accused her of shirking her duty as a mother. Joe Straczynski says he spent about a year investigating the case.
County courthouse, county library, LA Times morgue, criminal courthouse records, medical records.
Medical records, because Captain Jones was afraid Christine Collins would publicly embarrass the Los Angeles Police Department, so he had her committed to an insane asylum.
Because the police had brought back the wrong child and refused to admit that they'd made a mistake, they had to somehow say that this woman is nuts. And the best way to reinforce that was to literally incarcerate her.
The misfortunes of Christine Collins were big news in California in the late 1920s. The Los Angeles Times ran headlines like, New Kidnapping Clue in Hunt for Missing Collins Boy, Enigma Boy Identified, and Mother Sues City and Police for $500,000. A popular Presbyterian minister named Gustav Brigleb took up her cause. Played by John Malkovich in the movie, Brigleb's disgust with the Los Angeles Police Department was legendary.
But given its status as the most violent, corrupt, and incompetent police department this side of the Rocky Mountains, I am not sure it's saying a great deal.
When she was locked up, he was one of the foremost voices increasing her visibility to let people know what had happened.
The Reverend Brigleb's grandson, Ross, says he grew up hearing about the crusading minister who wanted to clean up L.A. But this new movie took him by surprise.
I never in my wildest dreams thought my grandfather would be portrayed in a movie, but on the other hand, he was a fairly famous guy.
Christine Collins' story is one that just when you imagine things can't get any worse, they do. Her son's body was never found, but it's almost certain that he was one of the victims in the so-called Wineville chicken murders. Gordon Stewart Northcott was convicted of killing three boys on a chicken ranch. His mother was convicted of killing Walter Collins. The brutality of the crimes created such a nightmarish image, Wineville changed its name to Mira Loma. But Joe Straczynski says he did not want the film to focus on the atrocities.
The best way and the most honorable way to tell the story was from her perspective. It really is about her war and her battle to find her son and what happened to her son.
I used to always tell him, you never start a fight, but you always finish it. And then I didn't start this fight, but I'm going to finish it.
Everyone around her had an agenda, a political agenda, personal agenda. The only clear voice in this entire story is hers.
Joe Straczynski made a name for himself in science fiction and writing comic books, including Spider-Man. He says Christine Collins is almost like a real-life superhero. Elizabeth Blair, NPR News.
Synecdoche, a figure of speech in which a part is used to represent the whole, or a whole to represent a part. It's also the most abstract movie title of the year, Synecdoche, New York. It's the directorial debut of Charlie Kaufman, the writer of Being John Malkovich, Adaptation, and Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. And like those movies, Synecdoche is challenging, funny, and at times just plain bizarre. The lead character is a theater director named Caden Cotard, played by Philip Seymour Hoffman. When his wife leaves him and takes their daughter overseas, Cotard decides his next production will be a recreation of his own life, staged on a grand scale, with hundreds of actors and an enormous set.
The idea is to do a massive theater piece, an uncompromising, honest, here's what I think theater is. It's the beginning of thought. It's the truth not yet spoken. It's what a man feels like after he's been clocked in the jaw. It's love. Oh, it's messiness. No. I want all of us, players and patrons alike, to soak in the communal bath of it, the mikvah, as the Jews call it. Because we're all in the same water, after all.
Philip Seymour Hoffman joins us from New York. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
That's quite a description of the theater. What's it like to hear that scene again?
It's well, because that scene, you know, he is talking about. I do think what he's saying, he really believes. Really, you know, I think he sees that life and art kind of mix, kind of go together. They can't be separated. And to have something, you know, if you're going to create something, you should create something that is that profound, you know. But he's also trying to win back a girl that he lost. And he's not succeeding.
Yeah, it's not working too well.
It's not working as he kind of gets dark, gets more and more odd with his description of the theater.
I want to talk to you about how you came to understand this character, Caden Cotard. He's a theater director. His wife has left him and taken their daughter to Germany. And over the years, he's developing all sorts of horrible physical ailments. A lot is going wrong with his life.
Yeah. I think one of the things is that you really are checking in on his life over a 40-year span. And that time in the movie goes faster and faster as you move through it. And so all those ailments and stuff, you have the sensation that it's all happening over a short period of time. But actually all those ailments and those things that he's suffering from are happening over a 40-year span. And isn't that how life is? Life kind of stacks on top of itself. In this film, I think it kind of explores that. That's how I would describe it. The life doesn't splay out in front of you like in a road that goes farther and farther forward, that it actually lays on top of itself. And also I think he's just kind of honestly trying to look at his life and the fact that he knows he's going to die, and he's not trying to deny that or look away from that. He's actually trying to look right into that. So his kind of obsession with being sick or his physical ailments or his neurosis about it is somewhat heightened just because of what he's interested in doing and interested in looking at and interested in creating and all that stuff.
At the beginning of the movie, your character is directing Death of a Salesman. And there's an interesting little parallel here. I've read that one of your first big roles when you were in high school was playing Willie Loman.
That's right. When I was a senior in high school. And I remember at that time I came to New York to audition for NYU while I was rehearsing that play. And I saw Dustin. I actually got one last ticket, I think, to the last – one of the second-to-last performance of Death Wish that Dustin Hoffman was in. And I remember seeing that and being so blown away by it. I remember going back and just trying to copy him.
Well, apparently it worked. I mean, you got amazing reviews back in
from my classmates. But I remember that. I remember going back going like, oh, God, I just remember how he did it. How did he do it? he was so incredible.
I read an interesting comment from your mom, someone relating what your mom said, that she came out of seeing you in this play. She had no idea how good you are. She was blown away.
Yeah, I think they're all – I was, you know, my mom took me to the theater when I was 12, and I fell in love with it on the spot, and that's a true story. That's not one of those fairy tale stories. It's actually – I fell in love with it. I thought it was a miracle. I thought, well, how the hell do people get up in front of you and make you believe something that's not true? You know, I just couldn't – I couldn't wrap my head around it. I thought it was the most amazing thing ever.
I wonder what you were getting at such a young age watching live theater that you weren't getting watching movies or watching television. That magic wasn't there in the same way?
No, I definitely saw films and was, you know, so moved. But the theater, so they're right there. They got up and they, you know, I'm sitting here and they're doing it in front of me. But the only difference is that they're doing it and I'm watching. But ultimately, we're all people hanging out in the same building. I don't know if that makes any sense, but it kind of put everyone on the same level. I was kind of awed by them, you know, because they were right there in front of me doing it. Whereas with film, there's this distance, you know what I mean? Not that you don't get very engrossed with the movie and get very moved, and it's a beautiful thing. But you don't know where those people are. You don't feel like you're ever going to meet those people. And that's how I felt. I'm never going to meet those people. I don't know where those people are. Those are very special people, you know, doing these very special things somewhere. You know, I just didn't get it, you know, and I didn't think I'd ever be a part of it.
You have played a lot of troubled characters. People describe them in different ways. And I'm curious, when you look at the roles that you're choosing, do you need to find some germ of likability in there? Is it important for you to be able to be empathetic with the character you're playing?
Yeah, you have to. Well, I would say you have to be an advocate for them. You know, you're their attorney. You're the you're the public defender for your characters you play. You have to plead their case. You have to, you know, explore and ask the questions and investigate the life of this character in a way that where you would be able to advocate for them, because that's the only way you can get behind it and make it personal. You know, and political for yourself. So that's it. But I also, with the exception of maybe a few roles, I don't think really anybody I've played is any extraordinarily weird or stranger than, you know, most people walking the planet. Just, I think people are kind of weird. And people go through rough patches. And film and theater and novels, and, you know, the stories, fiction, is about drama. You know, it's about the person struggling. It's about the person trying. You know, sometimes they succeed, sometimes they don't. But that's what it's about. And I just think I think that most people understand that.
Well, Philip Seymour Hoffman, it's been great talking with you. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Philip Seymour Hoffman stars in the new film Synecdoche, New York.
The only bromide in Hollywood older than Boy Meets Girl is that movies are recession-proof. Now, this cliché dates way back to the days of the Great Depression, when the only things that anyone seemingly could spare a dime for were bootleg liquor and Busby Berkeley musicals.
Out in Hollywood, the sensation of the moment is the picture called 42nd Street.
Makes sense. I mean, when times are tough, people want to escape to somewhere fantastic without having to pay a lot of actual escape to somewhere fantastic cash. And offering a couple of hours away from the ordinary is what movies do best. So, as our economy falters once again, will America look west to us godless heathens in Hollywood to lift the nation from its doldrums and make a buck to boot? History says yes. That recession-proof line isn't just Hollywood lore. According to Time magazine, domestic box office returns were up 5 of the last 7 times the economy was down. For example, 1981, we had the aftermath of the Iranian Revolution, a steep jack in oil prices, and Raiders of the Lost Ark, which snatched an arkful of $209 million. The 1973 oil crisis, God, oil again. Good thing we don't have to worry about that anymore. Now, that actually ran until 1975, and during that time, Hollywood cranked out hits like American Graffiti, The Exorcist, Chinatown, Godfather Part II, and then there was a little picture called Jaws, a $7 million investment that turned into a $69 million domestic first-run windfall. I mean, not only does Hollywood make money, they actually seem to make better movies during recessions. I mean, I'm pretty sure studio executives wish we could have a recession every year. And if there was ever a time us heathens needed some box office heroics, it's now, as the brilliantly executed writer's strike cost California billions in revenue and thousands of jobs. I mean, people all over the state are hurting. So how's this year looking? Well, this summer we had snappy financial receptions for Iron Man and the ladies from Sex and the City, Indiana Jones, again, and there was The Dark Knight, which at $527 million is the largest domestic hit in 11 years. So can Tinseltown once again buck the financial trend? Well, in Hollywood, there's usually a happy ending.
Commentator and screenwriter John Ridley has written a few happy endings and otherwise. He's also founding editor of ThatMinorityThing.com, and you can read his blog, Visible Man, on NPR.org.
For more about these and other movies, visit our website, npr.org/movies.